All right, good morning. Welcome everybody to Bio 241. It is May the 17th. Oh, and I didn't open up the schedule. Oh, you don't have the projector on either. Okay, projectors are on. Need to get back over here. Let's see. Let's talk about the festivities for the rest of the semester. So, yeah, it's going to take a second for them to come on. Okay, they're blank, but they're coming on. They're coming on. At least one is coming on. That's all we need is one. It's still coming on. Yeah, one did. Good. Okay, and the other one is probably not coming on. Oh, no, that's where I want to keep it over here. Okay, we can do that. We'll keep it on the right-hand side. And we want to look at the schedule. So besides today, the only thing left maybe is a lab this afternoon. In the lab, you have your regular quiz and then the extra credit quiz, the cycle quiz, the uterine cycle and ovarian cycle. Sometimes people think of them together as the menstrual cycle. In common layman's terms, you could call it that. But tailor your thinking for the uterine cycle, which talks about the events of the uterus, and also the ovarian cycle, which tailors your understanding of what's happening in the ovary as well. And hopefully you had time to talk about that in lab. All right, so there's something important about this class. In order for me to get lab grades, the lab instructor has to manually enter them. It's not like an online quiz where everything is done with a computer. And there can be errors made when they enter their grades into their grade book. And then when they give me their grade book, then I manually copy their grade book into Blackboard, and there could be errors introduced as well at that step. So you got to make sure that your grades in Blackboard are accurate. And we give you this week to do that, but after the final exam, I won't be making any corrections to lab grades. Right? Even if you scored 100% on a quiz, but it's entered as a zero in Blackboard, then zero is the grade you're going to get, because I can't tell unless you email me and let me know sometime between now and the final. Right? So that's in the syllabus, but I just wanted to make that remark. Make sure all your grades in Blackboard are correct, because otherwise it triggers an auditing process and administration of records, and it's a real mess that we can just avoid if people just check their grades. All right, so today is the 17th. Yeah, it is the 17th, and our final exam is May 24th, which is Thursday, and it's just going to be a regular test. So you have a couple hours to take it. You get the whole time, 10:30 to 12:30. It's going to be in this room, and the material on that test is going to be cardiac output, blood flow, blood volume, which is chapter 14, respiratory, which is 16, and renal physiology, which is 17, but not diversification system, with one exception, and that is the figure, the extra credit figure that you did in lab today. I might put that figure on the final exam, but no questions from the end of that chapter or online questions. Okay, so please be aware of that. So I'm going to erase those labels, and then you just have to relabel. So it's going to be just like dragging, dropping, or labeling that figure. I won't ask you any questions about that diagram, which is too bad. That's the way it goes. Okay. All right. So anybody got a question on when the test is? What is going to be covered on the test? Okay. What's going to be on the test? All right. I'll start from the beginning. So you can listen to this online if you want to. May 24th is the last exam. We call that exam 5, or final exam, but it's not cumulative. It's going to cover chapters 14, which is cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure, chapter 16, which is respiratory physiology, chapter 17, which is renal physiology, and the one figure that shows the ovarian and uterine cycle all justified together on days of the cycle. Okay, that one figure from chapter 20. Okay, so that's pretty much it. So let's get started with today's lecture. I might be able to help you out with some of this stuff. Let's see how much we can go over. And I guess I do have a little comment as I set up my pointer options right here. All right, I had to be gone on Tuesday. So did you guys feel abandoned and orphaned that I wasn't here? Or did somebody come in and give you a lecture?
No.
I got, somebody came in, good. So I tried to find somebody to come in and go over material for you. That's good, you weren't just left out in the cold. Door was unlocked, you could get into class, excellent. Okay, well that's what I wanted to know. Okay, kidney function, just generally speaking, is to regulate plasma and interstitial fluid, which is connected to plasma by capillaries, all right, by forming urine. So we're going to look at that process. And the process of urine formation takes place in the kidneys, and when it does that, the kidneys help regulate blood volume. You still don't see it? Oh, it's on the wrong screen. How do I get, oh, I have to come over here to get it on the other screen. I can't do it from over there. I can do this, I think. And I can look on the left, and you can look on the right, and I can turn some of these lights down. Yeah, thanks for letting me know. Yeah, so this is it right here. Okay, so the kidneys regulate blood volume, and when you regulate blood volume, you regulate a number of different things. One of the things is end-diastolic volume, or the stretching of the heart, and that's an intrinsic property of the heart. So when blood volume is regulated, then you regulate contractility of the heart, which then goes to regulating blood pressure. So the kidneys are definitely involved in regulating blood pressure. It regulates waste product removal in the plasma, right? And concentration, the proper concentration of electrolytes, including calcium and sodium, potassium. Do you think these are important? You should be able to think of a number of processes where these electrolytes are important. And because they're electrolytes, they determine the electrical properties of the body. And remember, every cell in your body acts like a battery. You're very electrical by your just general nature, right? And also then the kidneys regulate plasma pH. All right, so besides buffers in your body, the kidneys can secrete excess hydrogen ions into urine, thereby raising the pH of your body. All right, the gross structure of the kidneys and the urinary system, we're not going to cover at all because you should know this from anatomy, but basically the urinary system is pretty simple. You just have a kidney, a ureter, a urinary bladder. The kidneys are producing urine all the time, 24 hours a day. Right, and that urine is collected in the urinary bladder right here until there's a proper time to void the bladder, and then the bladder is voided via this tube right here, which is the urethra. And the tube that connects the kidney and the bladder are the ureters. Okay, the structural and functional unit of the kidney that produces urine is called the nephron. And you probably remember different parts of the kidney right here, but I see some tubular elements of a nephron, like Bowman's capsule, and a convoluted tubule connected to Bowman's capsule. That's a proximal. Then there's a loop of Henle, descending and ascending loop. And then here's a distal convoluted tubule. And the collecting duct that takes urine to a tip of a renal pyramid, right, that then gets collected by a minor calyx, minor calyces, anastomose together to form a major calyx. And then draining urine from a major calyx is the pelvis, and then finally into the ureter, into the urinary bladder. So I'm sure you know about all these different things. The sphincters, I don't think I even want to go over, but you should know all of those. So here's a good question that you should just shout the answer out to, and that is, what is the structural and functional unit of urine formation? And that is the, okay, maybe you're not shouting it out, so what's the structural and functional unit of life? You learned what that was in this class. A cell. Cell's got a bunch of complicated pieces, but if you know all the individual pieces, then you know how life functions within a cell, right? And what's the structural and functional unit of muscle contraction? Sarcomere. Sarcomere's got a bunch of pieces. If you know how all those pieces work together, you know how a whole muscle works. All right, what else? How about the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? Synapse, yeah, between neurons. There's a synapse, got a bunch of pieces. If you know all the individual pieces and how they function together, then you know how these cells communicate with each other. So same thing for the structural and functional unit of urine formation, and that is the nephron. So if you know all the pieces of a nephron and how these pieces work, then you have a really good idea of how the whole kidney functions in producing urine. Okay, so remember from anatomy that when we look at a nephron, there are tubular elements and there are vascular elements. The fluid that's in a vascular element commonly is what we call, okay, in a vascular element, what do you have in your cardiovascular system? Blood, yeah, so write down blood right here. So there's blood in vascular elements and in tubular elements right here. We don't have blood, but what we have is a fluid that leaves the blood when it enters the nephron, and we call that filtrate. And filtrate then is going to be processed by an interaction between the vascular elements and the tubular elements of the nephron, and eventually it's going to come out urine. So it starts out as filtrate in Bowman's capsule, and it's processed, and when it gets into the collecting ducts, then that filtrate becomes urine. We're going to look at some of those processes that convert filtrate or process filtrate so that it can become urine. So you should be able to draw out a nephron with these different elements right here. Okay, I'm not going to do that in class, but that's something that you would do in anatomy. Here is the nephron, but to go over it really quickly, the tubular elements I see in this yellow color right here does not contain blood unless the kidney is damaged or the nephron is damaged. Oh, what do we call it when a nephron is damaged? Nephritis. Yeah, and then you do get blood in this tube right here and then blood in the urine. There could be blood in the urine from other reasons, maybe a bladder infection or something like that, but one reason would be damage to this nephron. Right? The nephron should never contain, these tubular elements shouldn't contain blood ever. So the first segment of the nephron is what we call Bowman's capsule or the glomerular capsule. Filtrate, which is when plasma leaves the blood in the glomerulus, right? It ends up in Bowman's capsule right here, and then it makes its way through the nephron. Here is the proximal convoluted tubule, closest to Bowman's capsule, then the descending loop of Henle, and I'm only pointing out the yellow structures right here as a tubular element. This goes from the cortex down into the medulla, and then it returns from the medulla via the ascending loop of Henle and goes through the distal convoluted tubule, finally into the collecting duct, which takes it to the tip of a renal pyramid, and there a minor calyx then collects the urine from that whole pyramid. All right, so what we just described were the tubular elements of the nephron, but there are some vascular elements that you should be aware of too. And here is a blood vessel bringing blood into the nephron, that is the afferent arteriole. Here is a very leaky capillary, very specialized capillary, call it a fenestrated capillary. So a lot of plasma leaks out, becomes filtrate in Bowman's capsule, but not all of the blood leaks out. Some of it enters the efferent arteriole. And then there's another capillary bed that we call the peritubular capillaries. Peritubular because they surround all of the tubular elements of the nephron. And there's interaction between the blood and filtrate at this level, processing filtrate so that eventually becomes urine. And then all of these capillaries anastomose to form a venule, and then that returns to the renal vein right here. So this is an interesting circulatory system, because I see two capillary beds back to back before it goes to the heart. Here's capillary bed number one, here's capillary bed number two. Capillary bed number one is the glomerulus, capillary bed number two are the peritubular capillaries. They're connected by this vessel. What do we call a blood vessel that connects two capillary beds back to back? And probably by the class is over, you should know three examples. Okay, that is a portal blood vessel that connects two capillary beds. We see one in the nephron. Anybody remember where else there are portal blood vessels? In the hypothalamus, between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland. That's called the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel that takes hormones from the hypothalamus directly to the anterior pituitary. Okay, so that's highly unusual to have two capillary beds back to back. And there's another one in the digestive system between the small intestine and stomach, right? So there are capillaries in the small intestine that absorb nutrients and toxins, but that doesn't go directly back to your circulation. It goes to another organ first for detoxification and processing. And that is the liver, and there is the hepatic portal system as well. So those are three really good examples, right? Besides this nephron right here. Okay, so that's some of the anatomy of the nephron. All right, let's just go right to the glomerular processes. Okay, glomerular filtration. This is the first process that happens within a nephron. All right, these glomerular capillaries within Bowman's capsule form a filter for blood. And this filter is a lot different than regular capillaries because there are large pores between the cells of the glomerulus. So we call these fenestrated. That's a fenestrated capillary. They're big enough to allow any plasma molecule to pass through. So anything dissolved in plasma can end up in Bowman's capsule. But that is not really true. Large proteins typically do not move from the plasma, even though they are dissolved in solution, don't pass through the fenestrations. They're trapped in the blood and don't enter the filtrate. Right. Nonetheless, you should still realize that the glomerular capillaries are 400 times more permeable than continuous capillaries that you have in the remainder of your body. So these capillaries don't let cells through, like red blood cells, white blood cells, and large proteins. So if we look at the nature of the glomerulus, here we see a capillary. This is the wall of Bowman's capsule, and it's continuous with cells that line the capillaries. These are what we call podocytes. And so you could consider this like a serous membrane. Well, this is the parietal division of Bowman's capsule, and this is the visceral division of Bowman's capsule that lies right on the glomerular capillaries. And all of these different foot processes from the podocyte right here, okay, have special slits between them that we call filtration slits, which I can see on this diagram right over here. So these cells don't impede the flow of material from the capillary into Bowman's capsule. Okay, and also the capillaries. Now here's a nice scanning electron micrograph of the podocytes that are on the surface of the capillaries. Here is just a transmission electron micrograph that shows the lumen of the capillary. Right here, a little basement membrane, and here's a podocyte. Here are the foot processes between the foot processes of the podocytes, and then these are the slits between the foot processes that allows fluid to enter Bowman's capsule. Here are the large pores in the glomerular capillary that allow for fluid to leak out very easily. So there's an easy pathway for a lot of fluid to leave the plasma and enter filtrate. All right, but not all of the plasma that enters the glomerulus. Here we have the afferent arteriole. Here's the efferent arteriole. Plasma's entering. And these blue compounds right here, I think, are supposed to represent water. Oh, they're not blue. They're purple. Okay, but water, well, we don't have a water molecule. Do you see purple and blue or just purple? You see blue and purple? Green and purple. Okay. Well, water is not diagrammed, but water is leaking out, okay, which is the solvent for all of these solutes right here. And the purple are just small solutes like sodium and potassium. So sodium and potassium can leak right out of the blood into the filtrate, right, as well as some larger protein molecules, these green ones, right, but not very many of them. Right, they're still trapped in the blood, and they leave the glomerulus. Right, not all of the electrolytes leave at this point in time, but a great many do, and a lot of water leaves the circulatory system as well at this time. So movement from the glomerulus, which is blood, into Bowman's capsule, which is filtrate, is what we call filtration. And you could call it tubular filtration if you wish. That happens in this structure right here. All right, so name the process by which small plasma solutes enter the glomerular filtrate right here. What is that called? Filtration. That's filtration. Yeah, that's step number one in the nephron. Okay, the volume of filtrate produced by both kidneys per minute averages about 150 mLs per minute, 125 in men. Right, that total is about 180 liters per day, but it's easier for us to think in gallons. That's 45 gallons. That's a huge amount of volume that gets filtered. Right? So that is your water loss within the nephron. I don't know how many gallons a normal person is, but I would say you're probably, if I were to think of us as like a fish tank, I'm looking around the room, I don't know, we're maybe 50 gallons, something like that. So that means half of your body, a whole of your body volume goes through your kidneys every day. And you can't afford to lose that much water because you would dehydrate. It's important because it's to get rid of waste products and to produce urine, but we can't afford to lose that much water. So we're going to have to be concerned about that. All right, so most of the water that is filtered has to be resorbed, or death would ensure, right, through water loss. And I did a calculation one time. If the kidney wasn't to resorb water that gets passed through the glomerulus, I think we would dehydrate in a matter of 5 minutes or so. Okay? All right, so that's just an important process for cleaning blood. But that water then has to be resorbed. And that is controlled by something we call the glomerular filtration rate. And that's controlled by extrinsic and intrinsic mechanisms within the kidney. So extrinsic means that it requires structures from outside the kidney. Intrinsic means that it's a mechanism that happens just because the way the kidney is put together. Right? And so since it's done just because the way a kidney is put together, we call that autoregulation. All right, so vasoconstriction or vasodilation of the afferent arteriole affects the blood flow through the glomerulus, and then that's going to affect the filtration rate. All right, so if the afferent arteriole vasoconstricts, what happens to blood flow through the glomerulus if there's vasoconstriction? So blood flow, when a vessel constricts, what happens to blood flow? It goes down. Don't forget, by the fourth power rule, goes down in a big way when there's vasoconstriction. And then when there's vasodilation, blood flow increases very rapidly due to the same rule. Okay, so there are smooth muscles around those afferent arterioles that control blood flow into the glomerulus and then filtration rate. One important way that those smooth muscles are controlled are by extrinsic mechanisms, namely sympathetic innervation. So there is a sympathetic nerve that enters the kidney. All right, so here we see a nice flow diagram. So under the influence of decreased blood pressure or exercise, right, there's increased sympathetic activity. So for instance, if there's a decrease in blood pressure, the baroreceptor reflex can monitor that very quickly, right, because that's the most important short-term regulation for blood pressure. And the baroreceptor reflex integration center is in the medulla. That's the cardioregulatory center. It will make a decision to increase sympathetic tone, right, which will then increase cardiac output by increasing heart rate and force of contraction. Both stroke volume and heart rate will increase. Right? These sympathetic nerves will also constrict arterioles in the kidney, which will then decrease the amount of filtrate that's produced. And that's going to decrease urine production. And if fluid isn't lost in the urine, that's going to go to maintain blood volume. So what's the effect of blood pressure when blood volume is increased? So you can think of it in terms of venous return, but there's another really nice simple way of thinking of that, and that is just think of the tire on your car. When the pressure is low on the tire in your car, what do you do to the air inside that tire? Do you take it out or do you put more air in? Yeah, you put more air in and the tire pressure goes up. Same thing right here. If blood volume increases, blood pressure increases as a result of that. Okay. And then also don't forget these sympathetic nerves go to skin, cause vasoconstriction of the skin, and that increases total peripheral resistance. And what are the three terms that increase blood pressure? It is stroke volume and heart rate, which are a part of cardiac output, times what? Total peripheral resistance right here. So if peripheral resistance increases, that increases blood pressure as well. All right, so these are the extrinsic mechanisms that can regulate glomerular filtration so that blood pressure will be maintained. That's a very important mechanism. The intrinsic mechanisms are twofold. So, and these mechanisms keep glomerular filtration the same so that the kidneys will always be producing some urine, even when blood pressure is increasing or decreasing. So these intrinsic mechanisms are a little bit different than that extrinsic mechanism that we looked at. All right, and the two possible mechanisms are what we call myogenic constriction of the afferent arteriole due to smooth muscle responding to an increase in arterial pressure. Let me see if I have another slide on that. No, I can talk about it right now. All right, so think of that afferent arteriole that has smooth muscles around it. And if blood pressure increases for some reason, that means more blood flow is going to go through the glomerulus. You'll have more filtration taking place. All right, but these mechanisms are to keep filtration at the same level. All right, so when the blood pressure increases, the smooth muscles start to stretch, then they will be stimulated into contracting. So they will contract more to counteract the effect of increasing blood pressure. And when they contract, that decreases blood flow through the glomerulus and brings the glomerular filtration rate back to where it should be. That's just a myogenic constriction of smooth muscles on the afferent arteriole. Another effect is due to what we call tubular glomerular feedback. Right? And this is due to some chemicals that are produced that very local to the afferent arteriole, something in a place called the juxtaglomerular complex. And those substances are secreted that have an effect on the afferent arterioles to vasoconstrict them. All right, so let's take a look at the myogenic constriction here, and which is an intrinsic regulation, and here is an extrinsic regulation because it talks about sympathetic nerves. All right, so this first one right here is in place to maintain blood pressure. So it's going to decrease glomerular filtration. It's going to decrease urine production. All right, so when blood pressure is decreased, the baroreceptor reflex becomes activated, and it causes vasoconstriction of the afferent arterioles that decreases glomerular filtration because this constriction constricts blood flow into the glomerulus. All right, so that's an important feature of sympathetic tone on the kidney. Right? It's there to maintain blood pressure, not just to maintain a constant flow of blood through the glomerulus. In terms of the myogenic regulation or autoregulation on the heart, this is intrinsic. So this autoregulation right here, maybe you could pencil an intrinsic regulation of the heart. If there's a decrease in blood vessel, a decrease in blood pressure, what's going to happen to the diameter of the afferent arteriole if the pressure decreases? Think of a balloon and decrease the pressure inside of a balloon that you've blowed some air into. What's going to happen to that balloon if you decrease the pressure in the balloon? It's going to get smaller, okay? So what has to happen as this blood vessel gets smaller, it's going to decrease glomerular filtration. So at that point, the smooth muscles relax, and that causes dilation of the afferent arteriole when blood pressure decreases. So when these muscles relax, causes dilation, even though there's a decrease in blood pressure, there's still going to be the same blood flow through the glomerulus, and there won't be any change in glomerular filtration. This other one right here just goes the other way. If there's an increase in blood pressure, right, think of that afferent arteriole. If there's an increase in blood pressure, what's going to happen to the arteriole? Is it going to dilate if it's just a balloon? If you have a balloon and you increase the pressure in the balloon, what's going to happen to the balloon? It's going to get bigger. It's going to expand. The same thing for the afferent arteriole, but don't forget there are smooth muscles around that afferent arteriole, and as they start to stretch, those smooth muscles will contract and will constrict to bring blood flow back to where it was so that there's no change in glomerular filtration rate. So these are intrinsic mechanisms just due to blood pressure and the stretching of the smooth muscles around the afferent arteriole. All right, there's another effect that's intrinsic. We call this autoregulation as well, but it's due to tubuloglomerular feedback. So there is a feedback mechanism between the distal convoluted tubule and the glomerulus. They come back together. So the distal convoluted tubule passes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole, and we call that area the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, so if there's an increased flow of filtrate past these particular cells, the macula densa cells of the juxtaglomerular apparatus, as it passes between the afferent and efferent arteriole, it sends signals to constrict this arteriole, which will then decrease glomerular feedback, all right? So, or decrease glomerular filtration. So if there is a lot of flow of filtrate, a lot of production of urine, then the kidney is going to auto-regulate to decrease glomerular filtration so that we don't have too much fluid loss from the body. So that's what we call tubuloglomerular feedback. Two kinds of intrinsic regulation. Number one, tubuloglomerular feedback due to the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And then the other intrinsic mechanism is just due to the myogenic constriction of arterioles. That happens just automatically. All right, so that first process of urine formation is filtration, that it happens in the renal corpuscle, which is Bowman's capsule, and the glomerulus all put together, right? And all small molecules pass through those filtration slits and the fenestrations of the capillary. And we would dehydrate very quickly, maybe in a matter of minutes, right? But that water then is returned back to our cardiovascular system via the peritubular capillaries. So water is removed from the filtrate, especially in the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, so 180 liters a day of filtrate are produced. You don't have to use this term ultrafiltrate. They're just saying ultrafiltrate because those fenestrations and filtration slits are really small. You need an electron microscope to see them. All right, but only 1 to 2 liters of urine is excreted in a 24-hour period. So how much water is absorbed per day? Resorbed, taken out of the filtrate and put back in your blood. If you only pass 2 a day, but 180 liters of filtrate are made every day, that means the kidneys have to resorb 178 liters every day and put it back in your blood. Otherwise, you would dehydrate very quickly. All right, and this urine volume is adjusted according to the needs of your body. So if you're well hydrated, if you're drinking water all day long, then the amount of urine that your body produces is greater than when you're dehydrated. But nonetheless, depending on your water balance, the kidneys have to make a minimum of 400 mLs per day in order to stay metabolically active. Otherwise, they'll die. You'll go into kidney failure. We call that obligatory water loss. All right, so you do need to be drinking at least that much every day without causing kidney failure. All right, so how does that happen? So we see a lot of water that moves into Bowman's capsule by filtration, and then that water has to be resorbed, otherwise you would dehydrate very, very rapidly. So this process of resorption is from filtrate, which is in a tubular element, and it's put back into the blood. So resorption is filtrate to blood motion. Filtration is what? Blood to filtrate motion. So it's pretty good that you should see that. All right, water is never transported, but there are other molecules that are transported from the filtrate and put into the blood, and then water follows just by osmosis. So there are solutes that are actively pumped from the filtrate and put back into the blood, and since then there's a concentration gradient of solutes, water will move by osmosis from high concentration to low concentration. Okay. All right, so there's coupled transport. So what are the molecules in the proximal convoluted tubule that are actively transported? Let's look at this diagram right here. Here we have the lumen of a kidney tubule, but in particular the proximal tubule right here. And it's high in sodium, and there's glucose because these molecules are small. They've been filtered. And you're kind of familiar with this diagram already from a number of months ago already. So here is the wall of a tubule. Here we see a capillary. Here we see a little interstitial space. And what part of this epithelium is this right here? What surface is this? This is the apical surface. Here's the basal surface. And the membrane molecules, the proteins, the membrane proteins are different depending on where they're located, if it's the apical surface or basal surface. On the apical surface, here is a molecule or a protein that can transport sodium and glucose, right, down a concentration gradient. All right, so here you have sodium at a high concentration outside the cell, low sodium on the inside, and remember, every gradient has an energy associated with it. If there's no gradient, there's no energy. All right, but in this particular case, okay, the concentration gradient goes from sodium high, sodium low inside the cell. Now, why is sodium low inside the cell? because here is the sodium potassium ATP pump, which is on the basolateral membrane of the cell. And so here ATP is actively pumping sodium out of the cell, but not into the tubule, but into this interstitial space, maintaining low sodium inside the cell. All right, but that is also then pumping potassium to the inside of the cell. And that's going to be an important thing that I want you to remember even after the class is over, because there is one hormone, in particular aldosterone, that has opposite effects on sodium and potassium in terms of whether it is excreted or resorbed. And it's just due to this pump right here. I'll mention that again. Okay, so here's a cotransporter. It's using the sodium gradient to bring glucose inside the cell. So glucose is going from low concentration in the kidney tubule to high concentration inside the cell. Now, what kind of transport is this going from low to high? That's active transport, right? That's not passive transport. That won't happen automatically. And the energy source is this gradient of sodium. So this is what we call secondary active transport, because there's no ATP being used directly in this process. But in the kidney tubule, as long as these transporters right here are not saturated, it can take every molecule of glucose that's in the filtrate and put it back into the blood. Now, if glucose stays in the filtrate, where is it going to end up? It's going to end up in urine. Okay, and that would be a terrible waste of energy. That would be like you going to the gas station, filling up your gas tank with gasoline at $5 a gallon, and then taking an ice pick and putting a hole in your gas tank, right? So our body should not be losing glucose. That's an important energy molecule. Here you see a way that glucose, all of the glucose, can be taken out of the filtrate and put back into the blood. And when something moves from filtrate to blood, that process is what we call reabsorption, all right? So when glucose goes from low to high concentration inside the cell, now you have high concentration of glucose inside the cell, low in the blood, then glucose wants to go down its concentration gradient, but it can't get through the plasma membrane because it's a polar molecule. So what do you have to have in the basolateral membrane? A little protein for facilitated diffusion, right? So think of that little teeter-totter mechanism. Just by binding a glucose molecule to this protein changes a conformation of it so that glucose can move, okay, across the membrane. All right, so here's secondary active transport. This whole scheme works because of primary active transport. Oh, I should have asked you that. What kind of active transport is this? And how do you know? Because ATP, that means it's primary active transport. Okay, so this secondary active transport works in the apical surface because of the sodium-potassium ATP pump on the basolateral membrane right here. All right, so under normal circumstances in the normal individual, all the glucose is from the filtrate is transported back to the blood. All right, so sodium is actively transported out in the proximal convoluted tubule because of all those transporters and active processes. Right, and the proximal convoluted tubule is working 100% of the time, all the time. And as the solute, as sodium is transferred out, okay, that has a positive charge, look what it drags along with it. What does sodium need in order to remain electrically neutral? It needs a negative charge. And you know a molecule that has a nice negative charge on it? And that is chlorine right here. So chlorine moves from the filtrate in the proximal convoluted tubule, right, and is resorbed because it pairs up with sodium. And as these solutes increase in this interstitial space right here, as the solute increases, as water concentration decreases in this space right here, guess what water does? It moves out down its concentration gradient from high to low because all of these solutes, and that's all set up by that active transport of sodium out of the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, so a lot of water is resorbed. So resorption is going from filtrate back to blood. So the fluid volume is reduced to a third of its original volume in the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, but it's still isoosmotic. That means that for every sodium that moves out, it's balanced by a water molecule. All right, so 65% of the sodium that's lost by filtration and water is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule, it's returned to the blood. An additional 20% of the water is resorbed in the descending loop of Henle. Thus, 85% of the filtered water and salt are resorbed early in the nephron. And this is constant. The nephron is doing this day and night, independent of hydration levels. Right? And that costs 6% of all your calories that you consume at rest. Because what's using these calories up? What membrane protein? Yeah, the sodium potassium ATP pump, right? That's almost 10% of your daily allowance of calories is used by your kidneys just for pumping sodium, for resorption of water and these electrolytes, right? The remaining 15% of the filtrate is resorbed variably depending on the level of hydration. So if your body has a lot of water, if your hydration state is high, then you'll be secreting most of the filtrate at that point. But if you're dehydrated, then there are other processes within the nephron that can even resorb more water. And we're going to talk about that. Okay, collecting duct plays an important role in water conservation, right? It's impermeable to salt, but under certain circumstances, it is permeable to water. And it depends on the level of antidiuretic hormone. So if there's antidiuretic hormone, what's going to happen to water that's in the filtrate? It's going to be resorbed, right? It's going to be taken out of the filtrate and put back into your body, and it's going to be an antidiuretic. It's not going to be a diuretic. So, and that is maintained, that mechanism is controlled by antidiuretic hormone. So let's look at this illustration right here, flow diagram. When you're dehydrated, okay, that could be due to a couple of things, maybe excess salt intake or low water intake, going to produce dehydration. That's going to increase plasma osmolality, so the blood is going to be really salty. Fortunately, there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is connected to the posterior pituitary by a tract, so the hypothalamus sends action potentials down to the posterior pituitary. The axon terminus is going to release a neural hormone, in that case is antidiuretic hormone. Anybody know another hormone from the posterior pituitary? It's not involved with blood regulation, but it is oxytocin, right? There's only two hormones from the posterior pituitary. All right, this antidiuretic hormone then will increase, and it's a hormone, so it goes everywhere in the body. There are receptors in the kidney, and these receptors then are going to trigger a response in the kidney to increase water resorption. All right, so when we say resorption, which way is this fluid going to go? Blood to filtrate or filtrate to blood? Filtrate to blood. So when water goes from filtrate to blood, there's going to be less water excreted in the urine, all right, and that is going to then counteract increased plasma osmolality. So here's a nice negative feedback mechanism. And if the other circumstance happens where you're overhydrated, then instead of secreting antidiuretic hormone, the posterior pituitary will stop the secretion of antidiuretic hormone. That's going to decrease water resorption, and more water is going to end up in the urine because it's not going to be resorbed. All right, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. Let me show you, oh, too bad. I got to stop the slideshow to do this. Let me show you a nice exam figure. If I can see where to click. Good. And if I come down here, do this. Okay, I have a couple figures right here that are not in your textbook, but these are exam figures. Okay, so here is the key. Here's the practice exam for you. So let's take a look at this figure. So we have some compartments. We have a compartment over here on the left that kind of looks colored yellow, and that is the lumen of a kidney tubule. And so here is filtrate. And then here is the wall of the kidney tubule. And you can see the epithelial cells. Here's the apical surface. Here's the basal lateral surface. Here's a little interstitial space. And then here is a capillary in the medulla of the kidney. This is a peritubular capillary. When they're in the medulla of the kidney, we call that the vasa recta. So here's a capillary, in particular the vasa recta. So here's blood. Here's filtrate, and then here's the wall of the capillary. Here is the wall of the kidney tubule right here. All right, so how are we going to talk about water resorption under the control of a hormone influence? And this hormone is vasopressin. What's another name for vasopressin? Antidiuretic hormone, because antidiuretic hormone has a couple effects. One effect is on the kidney, but the other effect is to cause vasoconstriction, which will increase blood pressure. So this textbook likes to call it vasopressin. You could call it antidiuretic hormone, one and the same. So in the vasorecta, we have very high salt concentration, 700 milliosmolar. When there's vasopressin, it will leak out of this capillary, and vasopressin, or antidiuretic hormone, okay, is water-soluble, so it dissolves in plasma, dissolves in this interstitial fluid. Can vasopressin, or antidiuretic hormone, enter the cell all by itself if it's hydrophilic or if it's a polar molecule? No. So where do receptors need to be in order to sense the levels of this polar molecule? Cell membrane. Can't be inside the cell. So vasopressin binds to this receptor, right, and that generates a second messenger signal, cyclic AMP, and then cyclic AMP through a coupling mechanism activates these endosomes, and in these endosomes that are inside the cell, okay, they're loaded with aquaporin channels. These are channels that allow water to pass through one way or the other based on concentration difference. So they're not pumps, but if there's high concentration of water inside this vesicle, it will leave to inside the cell. If there's high water concentration inside the cell, it will enter the endosome right here. It's just a doorway for water. So cyclic AMP then is the triggering event that causes these endosomes to migrate over to the apical surface of the membrane, and then it just fuses to the membrane and thereby inserting aquaporins into the apical surface right here. All right, so now, under the influence of vasopressin, we have a big doorway for water to move across the apical membrane right here. And which way is it going to move? All right, well, we said that the osmolality of the filtrate is 300 milliosmolar. The cell right here is 600, so there's less water inside the cell compared to filtrate. Right, and water normally can't move through the cell membrane because, of course, it's a polar molecule. But if there's this aquaporin, water will go down its concentration gradient to inside the cell. But don't forget, it can only enter the cell if there are aquaporins in the membrane. And how do you get these aquaporins in the membrane? There has to be an increase in antidiuretic hormone or vasopressin in the blood. Okay, and where does that ADH come from, once again? Yeah, the posterior pituitary, okay? And that's controlled by the hypothalamus. All right, so now we have water inside the cell, but look, the blood right here is 700 milliosmolar, means that there's less water in the blood compared to the cell, so then water will move through, right, the basal lateral membrane and into this capillary by diffusion very easily. But this diffusion of water can only take place if these aquaporins are inserted into the apical membrane right here. All right, so that's a pretty important, that's a nice exam figure that shows the action of antidiuretic hormone or vasopressin. All right, so I wanted to get to that today. A couple more slides. All right, so here we see the three processes that will produce filtrate and then convert filtrate into urine. The first process is filtration, right? All small molecules move out. Resorption is filtrate to blood. Some molecules are actively resorbed, like sodium. Other molecules are passively resorbed because of the active transport of sodium. Glucose is only transported because of a gradient of sodium. All right, so here we have blood entering the glomerulus. Not all of the plasma is filtered, right? Some of it goes into the efferent arteriole, and as it does, there might be a number of harmful particles in blood that your kidney would like to get rid of, and a notable example would be urea. Right, so not all the urea is filtered, but a great amount is, but some urea returns to the circulation, right? But urea is toxic. So the rest of the nephron has mechanisms to sequester that urea and put it into the filtrate in the remaining part of the nephron. So if in the other parts of the nephron, you have solutes and blood that are put into filtrate. We call that secretion, which is the opposite direction compared to resorption. All right, so resorption decreases renal clearance, secretion increases renal clearance. All right, so the excretion rate is filtration rate plus secretion. That's going to add to the filtrate minus how much material is resorbed, minus the resorption rate. All right, so we talked about that already. All right, this slide right here talks a little bit about glucose. Glucose is a small molecule. It can fit through those filtration slits. All right, and some amino acids are filtered as well. But under normal conditions, 100% of these solutes are resorbed from the filtrate. They're not lost in urine. This occurs primarily in the proximal convoluted tubule. It's not regulated. These transporters are working 100% of the time. All right, and if a transporter is busy transporting one glucose molecule, then another glucose molecule in the filtrate can't be transported at the exact same time. So these transporters exhibit a feature of saturation, which is dependent on the concentration of glucose in the filtrate. So if glucose concentration is low in the filtrate, then there are plenty of transporters for glucose resorption. But if glucose concentration gets too high, then all the transporters are saturated and that glucose stays in the filtrate because it can't be transported. And where does it eventually end up? And I think we did this in lab. We did this test. Okay. So if glucose concentration is low, there are plenty of transporters that can transport glucose from the filtrate back into the blood. But if blood glucose is so high, like under what conditions do you find high glucose? Like diabetes, mellitus, if glucose concentration is too high in the blood, a lot of glucose gets filtered. It gets so high in the filtrate, there aren't enough transporters for resorption of all the glucose in the filtrate. So if there's too much glucose in the filtrate to be resorbed, where does it end up? So right now it's in the filtrate, can't be resorbed, it ends up in urine. And that's exactly what you guys did in lab, right? Because that's how we first would diagnose diabetes mellitus, is just by doing what? Just by tasting urine. Okay, if urine is sweet, then somebody has diabetes mellitus. You're all looking at each other confused. I mean, you didn't do that experiment? Somebody cut that out of your lab? Oh, some of you did that. No? Okay. I'll have to talk to your lab instructors about that. Okay. Okay, so that's what we call the level of the substrate, okay, needed to saturate these transporters is called the transport maximum, right, or TM. Right? Under normal conditions, glucose and amino acid transporters don't saturate because those concentrations never go beyond a nice homeostatically regulated amount. Right? And what regulates that amount? What keeps glucose between 180 and 200 milligrams per 100 ml of plasma? Like insulin and glucagon, right? They work antagonistically with each other, but if that system isn't working, right, then you have glucosuria. You have glucose spilling into the urine because the renal plasma threshold, which is this 200 milligrams per 100 mLs plasma, is exceeded. And then glucose is going to be lost in the urine. Okay? That's what we would call hyperglycemia. When you have too much glucose in the blood, that produces a condition called diabetes mellitus. That hyperglycemia then results in glycosuria, glucose being lost in the urine. Okay, one last topic for today. I got to get to at least one more figure. I don't know if I can talk about all these things, but at least one more exam figure. Okay, and this has to do with electrolyte balance. So far, we've taught, and glucose is a solute, but not really an electrolyte. So we've talked about some solute resorption in the kidney, but mostly we've talked about water so far, okay, due to the proximal convoluted tubule, the sodium-potassium pump in the proximal convoluted tubule, and the aquaporins that can be placed in the distal parts of the convoluted tubule, and the collecting duct. But now let's talk about some of these electrolytes. Right. Kidneys regulate levels of these electrolytes. to control plasma concentrations. And you know how important this is for all the electrical activities in the body and contraction and nerve conduction. All right. Most of the control is done by aldosterone. Now, what can you tell me about aldosterone? It's a hormone. Where does it come from? It's part of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Oh, that could be on this test. I think that's an exam figure. Okay, aldosterone comes from the, maybe somebody said, adrenal cortex. Now, what kind of chemical is it? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Aldosterone, testosterone, progesterone. These are all steroid-based hormones. So this is a hydrophobic signaling molecule. Okay, so don't forget that. All right, so 90% of the filtered sodium and potassium are resorbed before the distal tubule. Right. The remaining is variably resorbed in the distal tubule and the collecting duct as well. So there's some processing of filtrate in the collecting duct according to the body's needs. So if last night you were up drinking margaritas all night long and have this big sodium challenge to your body, aldosterone, okay, will be involved with that. Okay, so it's regulated. It controls potassium secretion and sodium resorption. Now notice aldosterone right here. When you get to a board exam and somebody's going to ask you what the mechanism of action of aldosterone is, okay, it's going to be on the kidney. It's going to have something to do with resorption and secretion. And the questions will always be, it increases secretion of potassium and sodium, which means that it's going to have the same effect on potassium and sodium in that answer. That's the wrong answer. Or another answer might say, it's going to decrease the secretion of both potassium and sodium in the kidney. And again, that's the same effect, which is the wrong answer. What is going to be the right answer? Opposite, right? So even if you don't know which way potassium is going and sodium is going, one is being secreted and the other is being resorbed, what's the direction? It's opposite each other, right? So that's going to be the correct answer. And to maybe help trigger that, what is controlling that whole mechanism? Why are they opposite? Because the sodium-potassium pump is always working with sodium and potassium in the opposite directions, right? Okay, so that's just the key to understanding that. In the absence of aldosterone, 80% of remaining sodium is resorbed in the distal tubule and the collecting duct. When aldosterone is high, all the remaining sodium is resorbed. All right, so aldosterone does what? Is important for sodium resorption when it's low in our body, okay? But as a consequence of that, it causes potassium secretion. And then I want to go to, I can show you this figure, and then I want to go to another slide. So here you have potassium being filtered. It's a small molecule, right? And almost 100% of the potassium gets resorbed in the proximal tubule right here. But if potassium levels are too high, it can be secreted back into the filtrate in the distal convoluted tubule and even some of the collecting duct over here. But that's only when there is high potassium levels inside the body, and that's under the control of aldosterone. All right, so don't forget, this proximal tubule right here is working 100% of the time. It can't adjust how much material is being resorbed. But if there have to be small changes in concentrations of water or electrolytes, that can be done by adjusting these membranes right here in the distal convoluted tubule and collecting duct like we saw for vasopressin by inserting water, aquaporins, water channels. All right, so let me show you another exam figure, which was maybe up over here. Okay. So here you see a blood vessel. All right, so here is a peritubular capillary. And here's the tubule. Here's the lumen of the tubule, and the lumen of the tubule is color-coded with this yellow. Here is the epithelial makeup of this tubule right here, which is just a simple cuboidal epithelium. And then here's that interstitial space, and then here's the blood space. All right, so let's look at aldosterone. Here is aldosterone. And remember, what kind of compound is aldosterone once again? It's a steroid. Doesn't like to dissolve in plasma, so there are carrier proteins that help aldosterone dissolve in the blood. Some of it jumps off of the carrier molecule, and then it can move down its concentration gradient from this interstitial fluid. It can bump into the cell, and can aldosterone enter the cell right here based on a concentration gradient only? And why is that? Because aldosterone is a steroid, lipids can move across the cell membrane without any kind of transporter. Right, so aldosterone enters the cell all by itself by diffusion, and there it combines with a receptor. So here's an aldosterone receptor. So remember, steroid hormones are all hydrophobic hormones, have cytoplasmic receptors or nuclear receptors, which means they're going to have an effect on transcription. So then you got to remember what transcription is. All right, so let's take it one step at a time. So we got aldosterone inside the cell, binds to receptor. Receptor enters the nucleus, and it acts as a translation factor, okay, or a transcription factor. So let's go over, and what transcription, translation are processes involved with what kind of synthesis? Protein synthesis, right? Protein synthesis. So remember, protein synthesis has two parts. It's got transcription and translation. Transcription is converting information from DNA to RNA. It's the same language. Translation is converting information from RNA to protein, right? Okay, yeah, because it determines the primary sequence of an amino acid in a protein. All right, so now you have this activated receptor. It enters the nucleus, can become a transcription factor, so it can convert the information in DNA, and you know that's, how do you know that's DNA right there? Nice double strand, right? And then here it just tells you messenger RNA, there's going to be a single-stranded thing, and then what's that process of converting DNA into RNA? That's transcription, right? So this thing indeed was acting as a transcription factor. This messenger RNA leaves the nucleus into the cytoplasm, which is where the second part of protein synthesis takes place, which is what you know as translation. It's going from one language to another, from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language, right? So translation happens in the cytoplasm right here that produces a whole bunch of different kinds of proteins. So it's going to change the metabolism of the cell drastically. So these proteins have a number of possibilities. They could be new pumps, right? New sodium-potassium ATP pumps, right? They could be new channels that are placed into the apical surface over here. Or they could be protein regulator molecules that regulate whether these channels are opened or closed, right? So they can regulate existing channels. And they can even regulate the sodium-potassium pumps over here as well. So they are just building the machinery, the doorway, and the regulation for the machinery in the doorway is all controlled by aldosterone. All right, so I think a good place to start is with the sodium-potassium ATP pump right here, which is going to be pumping sodium out of the cell. That is going to enter the blood. That means what's the concentration of sodium inside the cell right here if this ATP pump is working? It's going to be low because it's getting pumped out of the cell. All right, and if here you have high sodium in the filtrate because it got filtered, which way is sodium going to go? It's going to enter the cell, and what do we call that process when sodium goes down its concentration gradient due to just passive diffusion and then also actively being pumped out of the cell into the blood? That is resorption of sodium. All right. Now, don't forget, this ATP pump right here is pumping potassium inside the cell, so what's the concentration of potassium inside the cell? It's high, all right? And if there's this channel right here, and if it's open, what happens to that potassium? It leaves the cell, and it goes into the filtrate, and that process is what we call secretion, and that is controlled by what hormone? Aldosterone. All right, so what's the effect of aldosterone on sodium and potassium? It increases sodium resorption and potassium secretion by this really nifty mechanism right here, but notice that it requires transcription. It takes a little while. This cannot help regulate your blood pressure or blood volumes from second to second. That's why this is involved in what the most important long-term mechanism for regulating blood pressure. right, which is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. And this happens, right, this absorption of sodium happens in the distal convoluted tubule and collecting duct of the nephron. So the distal parts of the nephron, not the proximal parts of the nephron. All right, so I definitely wanted to get to these two figures that are not in your book today, right? In the exam study guides, you have the little practice diagram right here and the keys, okay? All right, let me just see if there's any one last thing that I really need to talk about. Not very much. Atrial natriuretic hormone, we talked about already. It comes from the heart when the walls of the atria stretch. It antagonizes aldosterone, stimulates salt and water excretion by antagonizing aldosterone, right? And as salt stays in the filtrate, right? And then that just inhibits water resorption as well. So that's a diuretic. Atrial natriuretic peptide secretes sodium into the filtrate. All right, that was a little fast, but I think you have what we looked at on these slides right here, these exam diagrams. Okay, we looked at these processes and physical chemistry of these processes throughout the whole semester. So that's why I went fast over them. All right, sign-in sheet is going around. And the next exam is on Thursday. Did I pull the syllabus up? Yeah, I showed you already. What about SI? Is there another SI session? I don't think so. That's it. Okay. All right, then I'll send an email out what my office hours are for next week.